Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How long will U.S. troops remain in Afghanistan, and might our efforts there have been more successful had we withdrawn a long time ago? Last Saturday's devastating Taliban attack on a Chinook transport helicopter was the single most deadly incident in a decade of war there, killing 30 U.S. service members and 8 Afghans. But long before the latest round of violence, my guest today used his firsthand knowledge of the conflict to conclude the United States should end its commitment to that war. Matthew Ho is director of the Afghanistan Study Group. He formerly served as a captain in the U.S. Marines, then in the Pentagon, and finally as a senior civilian officer in Afghanistan for the State Department, a job he quit nearly 2 years ago in protest of the war. Ho is in town to speak to the Dallas Peace Center's summer dinner lecture series on rethinking U.S. strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That event takes place tomorrow night at 7 at Fun Asia in Richardson. Matthew, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks, Chris.
Let's talk a little bit about your professional history. As you told the New York Times when you resigned from the State Department, you are not some pot-smoking peacenik who wants everybody to be in love. How did your thinking about our involvement in Afghanistan start to depart from the official U.S. position?
A lot of it just goes back to my service in Iraq. Served twice in Iraq, once on a State Department team doing reconstruction. For a year in 04 to 05. And then in Iraq again, I was mobilized with the Marine Corps and had a reserve company of Marines, and we were in Anbar Province in 06, 07. And in between all those times, working for Department of Defense or working for the State Department on Iraq issues and to a lesser extent Afghan issues. But really what it was going to Afghanistan, going back to war for a third time, and seeing the same mistakes being made that we made in Iraq in 03, 04, 05, just the inability to have any type of intellectual rigor or candor to our policies, to not understand what we actually gotten ourselves into, to not understand in the sense like when in Iraq or in Iraq where we were helping to propagate a civil war, our policies were putting the different sects within Iraq at each other's throats. Well, in Afghanistan, where the war had been going on for decades before we showed up in 2001, our policies there were doing much the same thing in terms of basically the U.S. was serving as a player in the conflict as opposed to an arbiter or a mediator trying to resolve the conflict. So, you know, there are several things, you know, chief among that being that this policy is just not going to work and I'm not going to participate in it. But then there was also a moral aspect to it where the loss of life was just so wasteful, whether it was American lives or Afghan lives or the coalition lives who are over there with us, that I just didn't want to take part in any longer. And the fact that we were not fighting al-Qaeda. We were taking part in someone else's civil war, and that was not providing for greater security benefits to the United States or to the West. And so ultimately what it came down to for me was, look, do you want to take part in a war that back home a mother or a wife is being told her son or husband had just died keeping America safe from another 9/11 when you know that's not the case? Or do you want to move on with your life? And that's what I intended to do. I intended to just quit, be done with the wars. You know, the wars have been part of my daily life since 2003. And but somehow now, 2 years later, I'm here still talking about it.
Your letter of resignation was taken very seriously by the State Department when you turned it in. In fact, you were asked to stay. Are you at liberty to say whether there were high-ranking officials who told you, if nothing else, behind closed doors, look, we agree with you, Matthew, but we're in a tough spot here?
Yeah. Yeah. I've not wanted to betray confidences, but yeah. I mean, I can say, you know, I was offered to positions not to shut me up. You know, the one position was to stay on at the embassy and work for Ambassador Eikenberry as his personal representative to General McChrystal at the time. And then coming back, I was offered a position by Ambassador Holbrooke, the late Ambassador Holbrooke, to serve on his staff in Washington. And I think it's because both those gentlemen and their staffs, as many others, agree with my basic points, agree with my basic position that, look, we're just taking part in someone else's civil war here. This is not keeping America safe, and our policies are just exasperating the conflict. And, you know, Chris, it's not the you know, looking back 2 years later, you know, that's the case. Our policies have only made the conflict get worse. So and I'm certainly wasn't the first person to say that by far. There are lots of folks who, you know, were saying this in 2001 about getting involved in Afghanistan, that you don't know what you're doing. You're going to get caught in this trap. You know, I'd like to kind of refer to it as a couple of years ago, we were waist-deep in quicksand, and now after we've escalated and expanded the war, we find ourselves chest-deep in quicksand. And I'm not saying that the United States should not be involved in the region. I'm not saying that al-Qaeda is not a threat. I share the same goals that the president has for the United States in that area, the defeat of al-Qaeda and the stabilization of Afghanistan and then the stabilization of the broader region, particularly because of the nuclear arms race between India and Pakistan. So I share those goals, but I just see our policies as actually being, in the case of al-Qaeda, not affecting them because they're not in Afghanistan and they don't operate in any manner that around the world where you're going to affect them by the presence of large amounts of ground troops occupying foreign countries. And counterproductive in the case of particularly Pakistan, because our policies in Afghanistan have further destabilized Afghanistan, which have further destabilized the region. So, I mean, I'm not calling for, never have called for, a complete departure, wave the magic wand, be gone tomorrow. But what I am calling for is much more sensible policy, much more in line with our goals and a policy that's effective. That also happens to turn in be in line, though, with this idea of withdrawing large amounts of U.S. forces.
Was the manner in which the United States carried out the raid on the bin Laden compound the right way to go?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the RAND Corporation, which no one can accuse of being, you know, from the pot-smoking hippie crowd. You know, it's a DOD organization, mm-hmm. basically, a Department of Defense-funded organization, research organization. They did a study a couple of years ago, and they found that since the 60s, 84% of terrorist organizations have come to an end because of political efforts or law enforcement and intelligence efforts. And if you look at, in the case of al-Qaeda and its affiliates who are around the world, I don't think you could ever have a political deal with them because, one, they're not going to get into a deal with you anyway. But also, two, they don't have a real constituency. You know, in the case, say, with the insurgency in Iraq or the insurgency in Afghanistan, they both represented legitimate constituencies that you can make deals with. Al-Qaeda doesn't have that. And the other aspect of it is that that raid against bin Laden, that really is, when we talk about law enforcement, that's really what we're talking about. You know, a very precise, very surgical type of operation to go get the bad guy and only get the bad guy. You know, not to cause, as we say, collateral damage, not to impugn the reputation of the host nation or the United States, but just to get that singular bad guy. And so that's when we talk about, when others talk about this idea of going to a more law enforcement-based approach towards al-Qaeda, those kinds of things are what we have in mind. Now, the danger that you get into then is that is an easy jump from that to conducting drone missions across the world that have very little oversight on them. You know, that's a quick jump that can be made, and that's something that we have to be very careful of. So it's a our counterterrorism policy needs to be much more nuanced and much more sophisticated than it is, but it also can be much more effective that way.
The irony, of course, is heartbreaking that we did the bin Laden raid without the loss of a single U.S. Yeah. life, and then you had several members of that strike team brought down in the attack on the Chinook helicopter over the weekend yeah. by the Taliban. You are not alone among American analysts to observe that some members of the Taliban seem to be willing to possibly negotiate an end
sure,
to
yeah.
the violence. Does what happened on Saturday call that into question?
No. I mean, I think what folks need to always remember about Afghanistan is that before the Soviets invaded in December of 1979, 100,000 Afghans had already been killed in fighting. So the conflict in Afghanistan has been going on since the 70s. When we intervened in 2001, and I agree that at that point that was the right thing to do. That was the right thing to do was for the U.S. to intervene in 2001. But what we did was we intervened in a civil war, an ongoing civil war. And we just took one side out of power and put the other side into power, without addressing any of the underlying political causes of the conflict. And then we created a political system that empowered the winners and completely disenfranchised and marginalized the losers. And again, didn't do anything to bridge those political causes of which at that point was a 20 some odd old year civil war. Now we're in a situation 10 years later where those grievances have never been met. Those grievances have never really been addressed. So what you look at when you look at the insurgency in Afghanistan is that it is one, the most important thing to understand is it's not monolithic. It's very localized. It's composed of multiple local groups with different national level organizations over the top of them. So you have the remnants of the old Taliban regime that controlled the place in the mid to late 90s. You have organizations that are composed of former Mujahideen who have fought the Soviets. But the primary thing to really understand is that the bulk of the insurgency is local groups. And that they have real legitimate political grievances that are span the gamut from everything from dealing with blood feuds to having economic gripes to really just being marginalized or disenfranchised in a political system. The thing I think that people need to understand and realize about our government's role the last few years is that we have been very reluctant to deal with or talk with the insurgency. And when I spoke earlier about mistakes we had made in Iraq, this was one of them, was broad brushing the entire insurgency as a terrorist group and that we will not deal with terrorists and that they are all terrorists, when the reality was very few of them you could actually classify it as international terrorists. The bulk of them were fighting for many different reasons, chief among them being foreign occupation. We've done the same thing in Afghanistan. We take this very localized, very non-monolithic insurgency and classify them all as terrorists or basically call them all the same. And then we also have a victory narrative as too with this, where we have to win. We can't be perceived as negotiating. We have to get a W in Afghanistan. There's multiple reasons, most having to do, I think, with domestic politics in Washington, D.C. than anything else. But if you look at what occurred in Afghanistan in 2008, 2009 to 2010, you see, and I saw this firsthand, both directly and then indirectly in my role as a political officer there, elements of the insurgency wanting to negotiate in 2008, 2009, 2010. Whether it was through press reports from Pakistani and Afghan and Iranian news sources, whether it's from the Pakistani military or intelligence saying these things, whether it was actually from the Taliban's own website. And then when you're on the ground there, whether it was from direct interaction with them where they came to us and said we're willing to talk, which in one case with me in May of 2009 when I was in Jalalabad in the east, they did come to us and they did say, look, we want to come in and talk. And my instructions from Kabul, from the embassy, was ignore it. We're not going to negotiate with them. And so what you have is you had a lack of willingness on the U.S. to speak with these guys. And we took the attitude that, look, we're going to beat you. We are going to surge our forces. We're going to escalate the war and we're going to win this. And how many times did you hear Secretary Gates say that we're going to drive them to the negotiating table? Secretary Clinton say, how can you negotiate with them? They have the blood of 9/11 on their hands, et cetera, et cetera. So we basically spurred any offers that we had seen from the insurgency in 08. 09-10 escalated the war, and insurgency in return escalated as well. And now we're in a situation where we are today in August of 2011, where the war really isn't stalemate. And we've squandered opportunities where we could be in a much better place, a much different place now. Not a perfect place by any means, but a place where we may be able to have seen the war de-escalate as opposed to escalate into this very large, terrible stalemate that we're in.
My guest is Matthew Ho. He is director of the Afghanistan Study Group. He's in town to speak to the Dallas Peace Center Summer Dinner Lecture Series, Rethinking U.S. Strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan is his topic. That event takes place tomorrow night at 7 at Fun Asia in Richardson. If you'd like to join our conversation, we welcome your calls now to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Matthew Ho. He is director of the Afghanistan Study Group, a former U.S. Marine Corps captain who then worked in the Pentagon and finally as a senior civilian officer in Afghanistan for the State Department. He will speak tomorrow night at 7 at Fun Asia in Richardson to the Dallas Peace Center's Summer Dinner Lecture Series. The title of that talk is Rethinking U.S. Strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. If you want to be part of our conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. So, Matthew, despite the risk to our troops on the ground, you don't see the Taliban as an existential threat to the safety of the United States itself. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to put it. Like, what we're doing is we're taking part in a civil war in Afghanistan that is multi-sided, multi-layered, very complex, roots going back decades, in a culture that we don't understand. I mean, some of these things that I saw there, I saw was in a part of the country where a mayor was assassinated, and it had nothing to do with the Taliban, had nothing to do with us. He was assassinated as part of a blood feud that went back about 15 years, assassinated by a suicide bomber. So that's what our troops get stuck in. Our troops get stuck in the midst of these things. You see, with the high-profile assassinations that have taken place in Kandahar recently with the mayor and then the president's half-brother, Ahmad Wali Karzai, we don't think the Taliban did that. We think it had to do with other elements within southern Afghan society who are trying to leverage and position themselves in order to get all that aid and development money that we spend there. So it has more to do with like basically being caught in between like mafia hits than anything else. And again, our troops are stuck in the middle of this. You know, it's really tragic, but with the 30 men we lost this past weekend when the helicopter was shot down, you know, more than likely, I put it at 99 out of 100 odds, the guy who shot us down was just a farmer who is fighting us because we're there. There's very little connection between al-Qaeda and the Taliban. There was very little connection between al-Qaeda and the Taliban in 2001. Al-Qaeda was there, but, you know, it's so convoluted, so conflicted. You know, like I like tell people, the man who brought, you know, when you look at the 9/11 Commission report, the man who brought bin Laden to Afghanistan, Abdul Saif, who a terror group is named after for in the Philippines, he was President Karzai's choice to lead parliament this year. So it's a very confused, very convoluted, you know, it's a society our troops are don't understand. It's a war that goes on for decades prior to our arrival. And so we're just stuck in the midst of the civil war that has almost nothing to do with international terrorism. And yeah, as we were saying earlier, the real threat is al-Qaeda. But again, they don't operate in any manner that's going to be affected by having 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. If anything, what that does is actually leads credence to al-Qaeda's argument about them defending the Muslim lands from Western invasion.
Because they're not standing on a ridge somewhere fighting with guns. They're holed up and hiding and planning terrorist
attacks. Yeah, they operate in individual small cells around the world. I like to describe it as they exist as like an ideological cloud that floats on the internet. There really is no real great command and control structure to them. You know, maybe there are a couple thousand people worldwide, if that, out of a Muslim population of like 1.6 billion. I mean, so this idea that somehow you can go to war with an organization of individuals and small cells using fighter jets and cruise missiles and brigade combat teams, it just doesn't make any sense. It's idiotic. You know, and that's what I'd like people to get out of what I'm saying is that just as a cold, hard policy reality, our policies are not giving us the outcome we desire as a nation.
What about humanitarian justifications for an ongoing significant U.S. military presence there? This morning, the San Francisco Chronicle is reporting on women's groups within Afghanistan saying we will lose the progress that we have made over the past decade if the United States leaves now.
Yeah, no, been there and lots of other people. It's heart-wrenching. But I think the first thing I think most people would agree on is that the United States should not go to war to try and change someone's culture. You know, and if you're going to make the argument that we need to be in Afghanistan to protect women, then, you know, the next step is to invade Saudi Arabia
We are unlikely to do.
Which we are unlikely to do, you know. But, you know, it is true. No, that the Taliban, what the Taliban per se represent is an extreme form of Islam. It's an extreme form of the Pashtun culture. It is disgusting in a lot of ways. It's barbaric in a lot of ways. But I will also say that the people we are supporting in the Karzai government are just as bad. That the leadership within the Karzai government is composed of warlords, war criminals, drug lords, child rapists, that we are not supporting the good guys. The people that we are working with over there are not wearing the white hats. There are a lot of great people in Afghanistan, just like everywhere else. There are a lot of younger people who want to have a modern and more egalitarian nation. But
which they did have 3 decades ago.
Which they did have 3 decades ago, and which people will point to and say, hey, that's what the Soviets were doing there. And so a lot of it comes down to the war in Afghanistan, one of the ways you can look at it, because it is, again, so multi-sided and multi-layered, is that it has been one of the causes of the tension that exists between the urban and the rural areas, between the modern and the secular versus the traditional and the religious. So some of what we're doing is exasperating those tensions, which pushes people to support the insurgency because they see it as an attack on their way of life. It's interesting. Everyone knows that when the Taliban ruled, you had to have a beard that you could hold in your fist for men. It's not so common knowledge that when the Afghan communists ruled, you couldn't have a beard at all because that was a symbol of the rural traditional, quote-unquote, backwards way of life. But no, there are severe challenges. But with regards to women's rights, with regards to human rights, but that's why a negotiated settlement is the best way to preserve that. If the United States transitions its role to being a mediator and to bring about a real settlement, that's the best way to preserve any progress as well as to ultimately maybe achieve further progress. But, you know, I will agree that, yeah, in some parts progress may be lost. But I also say that if you're a woman living in southern or eastern Afghanistan and more in northern and western Afghanistan, your main concern right now is your children not being killed by a bomb being dropped in your house or them getting caught in the midst of a gunfight or getting blown up by a roadside bomb. Just going about daily life. The priority in Afghanistan needs to be to end the conflict and then achieve some type of negotiated settlement that does preserve some aspects of human rights, women's rights, et cetera.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak first with Christina in Arlington. Hi, Christina.
Hi. You guys were talking earlier about Americans not being willing to negotiate peace with the Taliban. And I was just wondering, what would that look like? What would they want in exchange for a peace deal?
Thanks for your call.
They're stated. Thanks for the call, Christina. The stated and clearest is the removal of foreign troops from Afghanistan. One of the biggest, if not the biggest, reason for support for the insurgency in Afghanistan is the presence of foreign troops. They also want buyback into the political process. They may not want the current political system. I'm assuming they would probably want some kind of constitutional reform. But the current system as it is, because of the way it is set up and the way we gave power to Karzai and then he provided that power beneath him really in a patronage or in a corrupt manner, they want to be put in a position where in their traditional parts of the country, they have a say-so in the government. So what you may see – you probably would see is negotiated settlements occurring at local levels, at regional levels. And then at national levels, because remember, again, it's not a monolithic insurgency. It's very disparate. It controls many, many local groups. So some things may be simply reaching into a settlement with a local local insurgency group that just says, hey, look, the police commander you're appointed here, he's a traditional rival of ours. We don't want him coming into this area any longer. Others may be, you know, buy into the provincial government in the sense that we are completely disenfranchised. We want to be a part of this. Or, you know, a lot of it has to do with the money. There, you know, I mean, 97% of Afghans' licit GDP literally comes from foreign assistance. And that money goes to Karzai and his cronies. So if you're not in Karzai's clique, you're out of it. Well, how do you make the process more inclusive? So there's a number of things, but chief among them is removal of foreign forces and then getting back to a system that is not as they see as corrupt and as disenfranchising and marginalizing. And then again, a lot of it will be localized, so different local disputes that have everything from traditional rivalries, traditional familial rivalries, to economic concerns.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Next on the line, we have Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Chris. Mr. Ho, it seems like we've, in some sense, been through this once before, in that we had, in the late 90s, the Taliban had been defeated, and there was a group referred to as the Northern Alliance. It was in charge of more or less in charge of Afghanistan, and then they got kicked out, and the Taliban became resurgent again, and that's what led to Al Qaeda's revival. Our ultimate goal is to keep Al Qaeda out of power. So, if the Taliban were part of a negotiated settlement for the future of Afghanistan, what is why should we assume that the Taliban wouldn't again use Afghanistan as a safe haven and training ground that led to their attack on us on 9/11.
What do you think, Matthew?
Yeah, thanks, Ed. There's a lot of things with this, and this is a problem, is that we confuse the Afghan Taliban and Al-Qaeda continually, and they're not the same. So starting from beginning here, if the Taliban were to come back into power, and first of all, there are two different organizations. Al-Qaeda, again, several thousand individual small cells around the world with an international focus. The Afghan Taliban, not to be confused with the Pakistani Taliban, which is a whole different group, although there are places where they all overlap, of course. But Afghan Taliban composed of tens of thousands of members and then tens of thousands more, probably 100,000 more in a constituency who are focused internally on Afghanistan, not on international terror around the world like Al-Qaeda is. But if the Taliban did come back into power, say, first of all, I don't think the Taliban would ever become strong enough to retake Kabul. I think that old Northern Alliance, which basically is the government now in Afghanistan, would be strong enough to defend Kabul. It would have backing from the West to do so. I don't think the Pakistanis would back the Afghan Taliban to the extent they did in the 90s to allow them to take power back. But say they did, why would the Taliban bring Al-Qaeda back in? They would just repeat a mistake they made 10 years ago. It would violate every red line of ours. And it would invite an immediate response from us. And we already moved them once from power. We would do so again. And so I don't believe they would do so. The other side is why would Al-Qaeda go back into Afghanistan? You know, when we talk about these safe havens, we're talking about, the places needed to train and plan. And you don't really need that much space. You don't need that many buildings. Al-Qaeda is set up now where, again, they work through individual small cells around the world. It'd be great if they went back and occupied Tarnak Farms in Kandahar, because then we could bomb them. But they're not going to do that. They've evolved. They've grown into an organization, again, that exists over the internet, that connects through an ideology that is cloud-like in its organization and its operations. So to think that they would go back just because that's what they did 10 years ago, I think is a dangerous assumption to make, and leaves us open to an evolved and very flexible terror threat that just doesn't exist like it did 10 years ago.
Can you talk a little bit about the financial costs of our involvement?
Sure.
This is from your website, but in 2000, the U.S. military budget, you say, was $370 billion. Mm. Last year, or this year, I should say, it's a little over $700 billion.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what we've seen over the last 10 years with the expenses from the wars as well as just the general baseline defense budget has increased so much. One thing to look at is that if you looked at the defense budget from 2001 and compared it today, just the baseline budget, not counting the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, you'd see that since in the last decade, we've increased our defense spending, by almost $150 billion just over the pace of inflation. So just general defense spending has gone up a tremendous amount. And again, because the reason has been we've been at war. And no one is going to say no to the military in a time of war. You can justify anything. Also, too, members of Congress and both parties are equally guilty, love to support the military. If anyone here has C-SPAN, I ask you to watch the next House Armed Services Committee or the next Senate Armed Services Committee and watch how many of our congressmen and senators, when the generals are talking, all they do is nod their head in agreement. And both parties are equally guilty. There's very little oversight or very little challenging of the Defense Department and what it wants or what it asks for. You know, for example, the F-22 aircraft. That aircraft costs $100 million apiece. It's never once being used in combat. The entire fleet is now grounded because the pilots can't get oxygen. Not only that, since January, the aircraft couldn't fly over 25,000 feet, which makes it basically useless in its air superiority role. So for 7 months of the year 2011, this fleet of $100 million aircraft have not been able to perform their mission.
Did you feel differently when you were actively serving in the U.S. Marines?
No. I think I've always been critical. I'm a guy from Jersey with a big mouth, I think. You know what I mean? That's one of the problems is we don't have – I think politicians or members of Congress are afraid to execute solid and valid oversight. Regular folks feel it's like not their place to question, but it certainly is. There's a great quote from Eisenhower, from President Eisenhower, when he was leaving office, and this was, and everyone's familiar with his military-industrial complex mm-hmm. speech. But when he was leaving office, he pointed at his chair in the Oval Office and he said, "I pity the man who sits in this chair who's never served in the military." And what he meant wasn't that, you know, having been a general, he was better, was that he could raise the BS flag. He wouldn't get snowed. He knew they would come in here and just roll people over. And I'm afraid that's happened to President Obama on several occasions where he has just been rolled over by the Defense Department because he doesn't have strong advisors. He doesn't feel comfortable standing up to the Pentagon. And, you know, he has no other choices or no other alternatives.
Matthew Ho is with us. He's director of the Afghanistan Study Group, and he'll speak tomorrow night to the Dallas Peace Center's Summer Dinner Lecture Series on Rethinking U.S. Strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Matthew Ho. He is director of the Afghanistan Study Group. He's formerly served in the U.S. Marines, then in the Pentagon, finally as a senior civilian officer in Afghanistan for the U.S. State Department. He'll speak tomorrow night to the Dallas Peace Center at 7. The title of that lecture is Rethinking U.S. Strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You can get to the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Doug in Dallas. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Chris. Hello, Mr. Ho.
Hi, Doug. How you doing?
Pretty good. About 2 years ago or so, I went up to the public library and looking for entertainment, and I found a CD that was called The Afghan Campaign. And I said, well, great. I can find out what our boys are going through over there, because evidently it's probably written by somebody who's been there. And it told of the campaigns and the camps in the north and the camps in the south that the soldiers had and how they were constantly attacked as they moved between the two or moved around the two. And we had the rival tribes, some of which fought for them, some of which fought against them. And it was fascinating because it so parallels what's going on over there right now with our troops. And I say our troops because the Afghan campaign was about Alexander the Great
yep.
and his trips through Afghanistan. And he never made it. I mean, you know, he never won it. He never took it over. All of these constant little civil wars and things like that. You know, and so when I say that we're not fighting a civil war that's 20 years old, we're actually fighting a civil war that's over, you know, thousands of years old. And I'm curious as to why we went and got ourselves involved in something like that.
Thanks, Doug. Yeah, that's a great point. And the other examples, too, are the British campaigns in there in the 19th century and early part of the last century. And it is. Fighting is in many ways imbued in parts of the culture. You know, one of the interesting things I found in 2009 when I was in the east of the country was that particular part of the country. And if you're familiar with the country, I'm talking about in Kunar and Nuristan provinces on the east by Pakistan there, was that there was a much lower percentage of attacks against our troops by the insurgents in that part of the country with IEDs or roadside bombs than by actually coming up and fighting us face-to-face. And that may have changed in the last 2 years. I'm not sure. But at that point, they still had this attitude in that part of the country is, we're going to come and fight you. We're not going to put a bomb in the road and then walk away and blow you up as you drive by. This is part of who we are. This is how we grew up in the culture we live in. And this is what makes you a man type of deal. And yeah, that's very true. But you know, how we got involved there was, yeah, very simply, you know, September 11th. And when we invaded the country, you know, chased al-Qaeda out of there, took Taliban out of power. And then we, I think, just let things develop. And I think we got into this cycle where we supported a system that where we put warlords in place. And those warlords, because of the sheer amount of money we were pumping in there, started grabbing more power, disenfranchising more people, marginalizing people, making people turn to the insurgency. And then really basically getting to the point where all we did in Afghanistan was offer the people of Afghanistan or people in parts of Afghanistan two choices. You either support this Karzai government, which is composed of possibly your traditional rivals. It's corrupt, it's illegitimate, it's predatory, or support the Taliban, which are both really bad choices. So I think that's one way to look at it. How we got here today is that we have never provided any other choice to a large percentage of the Afghan population other than supporting a corrupt, illegitimate, predatory central government or an insurgency, or the Taliban. So I think that's when I say how we have to find a way to become more of a mediator in the conflict and seek to stabilize the regions. That's one of the things we have to do is offer the Afghan people more choices. And it has to be the Afghan people's choice. It can't be our decision. We have to facilitate that choice.
To the extent that it sounds like you agree that it was the right decision for us to go in there in the beginning, when should we have left?
I think, you know, that's difficult. You know, I mean, I think we forgot about it. We went into Iraq. I'm not saying that if we had put 140,000 U.S. and allied troops into Afghanistan in 2003, that the situation would have been resolved. No, I think we just would have been in the same spot we are now in 2005. But I think what we did is we took our attention away from it. No one talked about it. I remember being in Iraq and hearing something about Afghanistan. Somebody knew somebody who was there, and you're just like, wow, those poor guys, no one cares. No one even knows they're still there. And so I think that's a lot of it was that we just didn't pay attention. We didn't have our best minds, our resources. We knew very little about the region. I mean, I don't know what the numbers are now in terms of Dari and Pashto speakers, which are the two primary languages in Afghanistan, in the U.S. State Department or in the Department of Defense. But, you know, I know a couple of years ago, it was we counted them in the handfuls.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? So we just didn't have people thinking about it. It's, you know, and then it just kind of I think what happened was the Taliban, the insurgency, went over the border into Pakistan. They reconstituted themselves through 2003, 2004, into 2005. They start coming over the border. And then, say, in a place like Kandahar, we put in place a government or in other parts too, say, in the east, a government that took advantage of the people, that used the United States, its special forces, and its money to further empower themselves. So they fingered their rivals, and so our special operators kicked down the door because those are the bad guys. Or they use all the money they get from our contracts to further themselves at the expense of others. So I think what you had was a population in the south and the east of Afghanistan that was looking for an alternative to the government that we had set up that was becoming more and more corrupt every day. And what they found as the insurgency started coming back over the border in 2004, 2005, that was reconstituted, was they found a willing population looking for some help, or at least looking for another alternative. There's a great book to read, if folks haven't read it, to kind of understand this phenomenon, is a book by Sarah Chase, who was a former NPR correspondent, called The Punishment of Virtue. And she describes what life in Kandahar, where a lot of our troops are fighting and dying every day now, was like in 2002, 2003, et cetera. And you see this phenomenon happening where we empowered warlords. We empowered just thugs. I mean, these guys are – people talk about – the connection between the insurgency in Afghanistan and the opium producers. I'll tell you, the government is in bed and involved with the opium dealers in Afghanistan just as much as the insurgency, and in some cases probably more.
So you referenced government contracts and the amount of money that flows from one place to another. You do believe that there is a role for ongoing U.S. economic investment mm-hmm. in Afghanistan. How do we spend that, and how do we make certain that it is doing things that at least morally we feel are yeah. acceptable and that may in fact have a positive impact on people there who right now are desperately poor and in many cases feel the only way they can put food in their families' mouths is by raising opium poppy?
Yeah, it really is. There is no other industry there in parts of the country, of a timber industry or in gem industry. There is Afghanistan traditionally was a transit route across the continents, you know, connects the Persian Gulf to Pakistan and India. But with the war, that's not a very lucrative trade route. So really the only industry there is the drug industry. The first thing needs to happen is you need to reestablish political order. Right now what you have in Afghanistan, and I don't mean to be crass, but the way I view it is as if you have a room full of non-socialized dogs, okay? And then all you do is throw red meat into that room, they'll never socialize, right?
Let me interrupt you for a minute. Because it sounds like you're describing an inherently dysfunctional culture that can't be turned around. Is that your sense?
No, not saying that. I'm saying this, the political system that we have put in place over mm-hmm. the last okay. 10 years okay. that we've supported, that we've basically continued to prop up, and then we continue to reinforce because we keep sending more troops, we keep sending more money. That's what I mean. When I say dogs, I mean like the actual political actors there. Mm-hmm. So there's so much money. It is. Afghanistan is, you know, depending upon what you look at, you know, what ranking, it's the second or third. It's incredibly poor. The majority of the people outside the cities are subsistence farmers. They've had a terrible drought there. Over the last 10 years, I think like 7 years have been drought. They've had massive deforestation. They've been at war for 30. So most people there are just trying to get water out of the ground to keep their families alive. There's a lot of good humanitarian assistance, a lot of basic development work that can be done that just won't be achieved until there's a political settlement. The other thing I think we have to do is we have to get away. The U.S. government has to decouple its development work from its political activities. And so, I mean, that means you have to revisit, one, the military doing development work, but also, two, the way U.S. aid does development work, that you have to have an organization that's not tied to political objectives or goals. Some will say, hey, you know, why spend taxpayer money then on development if you're not trying to achieve some political purpose for the United States? And that's a valid point. But I'll tell you that it doesn't work in the manner it's being done. USA right now is a very large bureaucracy. You can't show one place on the map where their efforts have diminished the insurgency or stabilized the country. In fact, what we see is the places where they put more money into, those tend to be the places that have the most conflict. And again, because the way we pump the money in there, different political elements fight over it. So that's where you get in the case of the mayor of Kandahar City or President Karzai's brother being assassinated last month. We don't believe it was the insurgency that killed him. We believe it was rivals jockeying, or one of the theses are that rivals jockeying for the money as opposed to the insurgency or as opposed to some other reason to assassinate them. There can be very good humanitarian. Where I've seen humanitarian, and I've served over in Japan and Asia for several years too, where I saw it being best done anywhere was when it's done through a non-political organization that utilizes local groups and local individuals and has as few expats involved as possible.
Let's go once more to the phones. This time we will speak with Bob in Fort Worth. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
I'm wondering about the education system. You know, if they're public schools and if there's anything we could do to help with that, looking kind of 10, 15 years down the road and thinking that if they were perhaps better educated, it might make the situation better. So I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Matthew?
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Again, we've got to end the conflict. We've got to get some degree of political order there first. Otherwise, nothing is possible. But absolutely. It's a country where in parts of the country that have been supportive of our presence, which is about 60% of the country, those areas you have seen schools built. You know, you hear the numbers from our government all the time, 7 million children in school, several million of them girls. But I'll tell you, in the South and the East, people want education. We have areas in – there are areas in Afghanistan that the insurgency that the Taliban control where they operate schools. Now, it's more in line with their religious and cultural identities than anything we would recognize here in the United States. But they do value the idea of education. I don't think they want to go back to that darkness they had, that really middle type ages that they had, that they experienced in the 90s. But absolutely. It needs to be decoupled from political agendas. But certainly it needs to be, you know, I mean, when I talk about the military doing these things, and I love them, you know, I love our guys, but you have to look in a sense of what if your 7 or 8 year old kid was in a school where at the front of the classroom there was a foreigner in a foreign military uniform. You have to put yourselves in that perspective and that understanding of why we have to decouple this from a military and a political objective if we're ever going to see real progress. But certainly, yeah, education, just like anywhere, it's an absolute necessity, but we have to end the war first.
Talk, if you would, about another thing the Afghanistan Study Group has said is that this war, the conflict in Afghanistan in particular, has been a distraction, certainly for President Obama and potentially for President Bush before him, from the economic crisis that this country has.
Yeah, sure. I mean, what you have is you have a conflict that is costing us $120 billion a year. Which is something that we really pushed this year in terms of our messaging and talking to people in Capitol Hill, and when we go in the media, and this was something we realized that this is what the average person is going to recognize and understand. They're going to feel that. A lot of folks don't know people in uniform. Most folks in this country, I don't think, know people who have served in Afghanistan. But everyone understands the value of $120 billion. And so I think that's been one of our strongest messages is, look, this country is hurting. You can go – if we were to – you know, over the past year or two, as I've been speaking, when I go and speak to certain areas, if I'm going to focus on the economic aspects of it, one of the things, Chris, that was really easy for me to do was just to – if I was going to go visit, say, come here – and I didn't do this, so I don't have the numbers in my head. But if you just Google, say, Dallas or Fort Worth and then police layoffs – and you see that there are communities that are suffering from police layoffs, from different municipalities being short on budget, and yet we're spending $120 billion on a war.
We're going to have to leave it there
for
time purposes. Matthew Ho will speak tomorrow night to the Dallas Peace Center. The lecture is called Rethinking U.S. Strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Matthew, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.